Welcome to Worker Movement, a podcast dedicated to the working class, a podcast dedicated to raising class consciousness. This podcast is for you, for us, for the worker.
There have been several events in the last week that directly signal that normal is coming, that capitalism is healing. The CDC spontaneously announced that masks were no longer needed if you're vaccinated. Liz Cheney got purged by the GOP for dare questioning their dear leader. And the U.S. reprised their role as world police by rejecting diplomatic attempts through the U.N. to resolve the latest Israeli-Palestine conflict. The politics of the Middle Eastern conflict are way beyond the scope of this episode, but we want to clearly state that the people living in the Palestinian portions of Israel, mainly Gaza and the West Bank, are not free in any sense of the term. They are a repressed group.
If you live in Palestine, you're essentially in an open-air prison because you can't leave. And the idea stems from the fact that if you're in poverty, you can't leave. You can't just pick up your stuff and drive away because you probably don't have transportation. You don't have a host country to accept you. You still need a passport. You still need someone to allow you to cross over in their country. And right now, effectively, everything that's surrounding Palestine is blocked. Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Egypt. You can't just take a boat to Cyprus or Turkey. It's all blocked. That's not how this works. They're essentially in open air prison, and now Israel is essentially bombing them with complex technology that the United States is giving them, which means that the U.S. is complicit in war crimes.
The most recent round of tensions stem from a centuries-long land dispute in Jerusalem, where Israel courts have historically evicted Palestinians from their current residences. This is enforcing an apartheid state, or as you just referred to it, an open air prison. We don't want to linger on the nuance or the history of this ongoing conflict. Our intent is to discuss the U.S.'s role and their actions during the May 6th to May 21st conflict. But as you just mentioned, the U.S. is an active participant. During the conflict, the U.S. invoked or threatened to invoke their veto on actions taken as part of the U.N. Security Council. The U.N. Security Council is comprised of 15 member countries, five of which are permanent, including China, France, Russia, the United Kingdom, and the United States of America. Each of the five member states have a unilateral veto. There are then 10 non-permanent member states that rotate in two-year terms. The current non-permanent members are Estonia, India, Ireland, Kenya, Mexico, Niger, Norway, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Tunisia, and Vietnam. As part of the UN Security Council, several nations, led by China as they have the rotating presidency during the month of May, introduced a non-binding statement. This statement condemned the violence in Gaza and called for a ceasefire between the warring parties, at least according to media reports. UN statements aren't subject to formal voting, but the US objected to this statement. France intended to introduce a formal resolution at the UN, which the US threatened to veto, again based on media reporting. Before France's resolution could be presented and voted on, outside negotiations, which the US was allegedly spearheading, yielded the globally desired ceasefire on May 21st. So the basic geopolitical question is, why was the U.S. opposing the statement through the U.N.? And why did they signal that they wanted to oppose the resolution as well? Roughly 300 civilians were killed during this roughly two-week conflict, counting both Palestinians and Israeli deaths. And some 72,000 Palestinians were displaced.
It's normalizing violence against poor people. It's hurting everybody that's over there. And quite honestly, from a U.S. point of view, I don't know how this helps anybody. If you're already worried about fading U.S. policy in the world because of big, scary Russia and China, you've now given them a reason to oppose you even more in the Middle East.
If you're the 14 member states of the U.N. Security Council right now, and you're voting for a ceasefire, at what point do you just stop politically caring about what the U.S. says? Now, the U.N. is set up to give the U.S. effectively a veto, so it's not like these 14 countries can just override. But at some point, what does the U.S. offer? The world, effectively, collectively, like, what is the single resource that the U.S. offers that all of these other nation states have to grovel at the feet of the U.S. for? I have no idea what it is.
When this UN Security Council was first set up, the US had bombed every manufacturer in the world, right? Every country. Germany was defeated. Most of Europe was destroyed, right? Japan was in ruins. Then you come back into the 80s. China was not yet a powerhouse in manufacturing. In the 50s, you had Argentina, who had one at the time the second largest economy, falling beneath dictatorship. So you really had just the United States as a global hub for manufacturing and resources and monetary stability.
So the UN was set up in some context to preserve the U.S.'s standing in the world, give them a perpetual veto over basically world's conflict. And in this instance, the U.S. is, I guess, raising their hand to further establish that they still have power. But for what reason? And we don't really know. But the idea is that the U.S. still has power through the U.N. to do whatever they want. And they're choosing to oppose this resolution. For what motivation? And think back to the reason the U.N. exists is because the U.S. wanted power to establish their economic dominance. So the U.N. exists basically to establish capital's dominance in the world economy. And you still have it enacting today as a sort of vessel for that with this really unclear resolution vote.
Let's be clear. Capital doesn't prefer China to sit on top because China at any point in time could pull back the reins of capital and absorb it in like it did Jack Ma in Alibaba, right? Now it's an investment group, technology investment group. So, you know, China's still a destabilizing force for capital. Most capitalists are still going to prefer the old guard because they know that's where the most stability is. The question, though, is why destabilize the Middle East? And again, from a capitalist point of view, we are not agreeing with any of this nonsense. But if you're already arguing that you're in South America, you're already within trying to go into the Asian Pacific realm and hold off China, and now you're trying to go into the Middle East and, I guess, bring back the old 1970s mentality of Middle East control, I don't comprehend it.
So Biden is effectively the pleasant face on imperialism that Trump wasn't.
Exactly.
And you have the general U.S. population willing and eager to support Israel's actions here when they're absolutely devoid of any good outcome or even U.S. geopolitical interest, because we can't identify why the U.S. is opposing a ceasefire. There is no functional reason that is observable that makes any sense. But Biden will smile and drive around in an F-150 threatening to run over journalists that dare ask about the Israel situation.
Mr. President, can I ask you a quick question on Israel before you drive away?
No, you can't. Not unless you get in front of the car as I step on it. I'm on a tease.
He just turns a blind eye to it, and the media is going to take the cue from him. They're not going to talk about it forever because they're going to get tired of it. At the end of the day, the accountability comes from changing the minds of those around you about what it means to support other countries.
So we have two analogies that attempt to describe what the situation is. The first one involves the police violence against blacks and general minorities. And the framing is the police go and indiscriminately kill black people at an alarming rate. What are the blacks supposed to do about it? There's no direct action they can take. And this is sort of the analog for the people of Palestine can't just leave. They are functionally stuck where they are because of the border issues that you talked about. They're geographically boxed in and they can't leave. It's an open air prison. The second example is Native Americans in the United States, where the U.S. government has been systemically committing chronic violence against them for generations. You can point to acute acts in the 1800s where the U.S. went and quite directly killed entire tribes. You have the Trail of Tears. You have some of the army actions in the Dakotas where you just killed Native Americans.
Either slaughtering of all the buffalo, or was it bison? All the food sources were wiped out, right? Putting on land that had toxic water, or no water at all.
It's directly colonialism. The U.S. has engaged in it. Israel is actively engaging in it. And it's not a surprise that these two nations are representing each other's self-interest because they both do the same thing. And they do the same thing with Joe Mensah smiling into the camera with his aviators on, just lying through his teeth and being a terrible person.
Absolutely. And the corollary of minorities within a poverty-stricken area is 100% true. There is no way for them to leave. There's no way for you to leave Atlanta if you live in Atlanta or Detroit or Los Angeles. There's no place to go. Where can you go? If you already live in low-income housing and you require public transportation, there is not public transportation from one big city to the next big city. That's not how that works. There's no guarantee that you can actually move, ever, because there's other things in life you have to do. It's an actual open-air prison. And then you have a police force, which is the same thing as what's going on in Israel and Palestine, policing you like you're criminals. Absolutely perpetuating colonialism because there's no benefit in you working because that is not how that works. Minorities are not designed to move anywhere, right? As you mentioned, you know, there's a stigma in, you know, the black villains or the, you know, the big scary black guys. And we're saying it this way because it's what the media says, and it's what the right says all the time, right? They use words and they weaponize words. The only way that we're really going to change the world is to change the world around us. And this is why it's important for us to act locally. It's why it's important for us to change what policing is, or change at least the stigma about it, right? This is bullshit. We do not accept war crimes of any sitting president or any local police jurisdiction.
The U.S.'s actions pertaining to the recent Israeli-Palestine incident can be framed as a police action, where the police exist to preserve the class divide and advocate for the interests of the ruling class. It doesn't make sense because it doesn't intend to make sense. It intends to preserve power.
So that leads us into another terrorist organization, which is the Republican Party, who does things like support plots on the Capitol on January 6th, who takes away voting rights, who votes to cut unemployment for people like they do in Texas. Just happened. I mean, literal terrorism against its own population state.
So at the same time, you have the U.S. administration vetoing U.N. Security Council votes for a ceasefire that directly relate to imperialism. You have the GOP ostracizing a member of the party that presumably supports imperialism, and in fact does. Not because of anything she did, though, related to foreign policy or domestic policy or anything policy related. It's because she took a shot at Trump and missed. It leaves the scenario under which the GOP is totally fine with what's going on foreign policy-wise with Israel. But the thing they are most presently focused on is making Liz Cheney the most left member of the GOP.
So she's the most powerful representative in Wyoming.
Well, she's the only representative. She's also the weakest representative in Wyoming.
You have Liz Cheney, who got kicked out of the party for criticizing Trump. And you have Mitt Romney, who is still part of the party for criticizing Trump.
He has money, though, so it's fine.
Liz Cheney isn't needed. She actually came from a place of weakness, so weak that they could just kick her out of leadership because she didn't actually matter. She doesn't get donations. She's from Wyoming, which is a shithole state. Unless you're from Wyoming and you're left, good for you. She doesn't pass anything. She's just a bench warmer. She's not good on optics. Kick her out. Mitt Romney, though, comes from a position of power. So the real question is how does Mitt Romney not get purged?
There is a faction of the GOP that has an ideology. And an argument could be made that it consists entirely of Liz Cheney, Mitt Romney, whoever the other 8 or 10 or so people in the House, and a couple handfuls of people in the Senate that voted to convict Trump. And we're not making a statement that they have a good ideology, simply that they have an ideology. Whereas the other members of the Trump cult are just followers of Dear Leader, and we talked about that on our previous episode. They're there just to follow directions. They're a contra demographic that was intended to serve capital's interest, and arguably they're not serving capital's interest anymore. What are Liz Cheney and Mitt Romney to do? In order for Liz Cheney and Mitt Romney to have any sort of political power going forward, they are going to need money. Like you just said, Mitt Romney has money. I don't know that he's quite a billionaire or has enough money to actually influence national politics. He has enough money to insulate himself from any would-be challenger in Utah. And there's also other issues in Utah that make him pretty much untouchable. He's likely to persist, and he could be the face of this ideological GOP that attempts to wage war, or however you want to characterize it, against the Trump cult. The most interesting thing about the schism is that both sides really support this imperialism. They're quite literally arguing over just internal party politics that have absolutely no analog to public policy. It's another example of capitalism healing, because capitalism will get to decide which side is victorious while still getting the same outcome, which is imperialism. And you see the Dems already engaging in imperialism, and you see the Republican Party having this internal struggle, but their default position is also supporting imperialism. So if you're a billionaire and you want to support your interests, why wouldn't you support Mitt Romney? Write him a check. Write Liz Cheney a check. Let them wage this internal war that creates this perception of good versus evil that potentially doesn't even matter because you're going to support the Dems anyway.
Capital doesn't want the chaotic libertarian or the psychopaths from Colorado truly having power. What they do want, though, is instability among the population who they're going to vote for, so nothing constructive can happen, so you can't get the tax reforms. They already got that, right? They already got their tax breaks. The more chaos that can happen, the less likely it is that the Dems are going to pass a tax bill that rolls it all back because they can't do it politically.
So if you're a billionaire, what is your incentive to support the Republican Party in the context of Mitt Romney or Liz Cheney versus supporting the Democratic Party?
Get rid of Liz. You can bring in somebody even more wild. even more deregulations. I wouldn't support her in for any reason.
There's no political motivation to support her, because you're going to piss off a large percentage of the Trump cult. And what do you really gain? A single House vote? Who cares?
Mitt Romney, though, is your tiebreaker. If Mitt Romney goes, the Senate can go.
The margins are so razor thin in any legislative body in the U.S. that you need every vote that you can get, but you also want to hedge by basically donating both sides. So if you're a corporation, you're going to support the Dems, which you did in the last election cycle, and you're going to take a flyer and support Mitt Romney and the Liz Cheney's of the world, because why wouldn't you? You can play both sides.
You donate to the winners, and you donate to both sides, so they both win.
The key takeaway from the Liz Cheney purging is that before, during Trump's tenure, you had corporations that were stopping their donations to the Republican Party. They did not want to be seen donating to Trumpism because it was bad for business. But now you have Liz Cheney and you have Romney and you have this other group of people that relatively few in numbers, but they present a viable option for corporations to play both sides. And over time, you'll see the Trump cult simply get less money because capital doesn't have any incentive. This entire paradigm shift of purging Liz Cheney really just creates the avenue by which corporations can play both sides again. Capitalism is healing.
Capitalism is healing because there was a shock to the system. Trump was a shock, right? The corporations lost control. They lost control over a demographic, which is the manufactured demographic of the conservative, the Tea Party, the Libertarian, the I love Confederate flags, love Jesus, hate abortions, love my guns, and we're being assholes about it, but that's what they are, right? That's the manufactured demographic that they can exploit. We love our military, we love our police, except for I don't like when the police pull me over, but I love when the police step on brown people's necks. That's the demographic.
The Republican Party needs the Trump cult to vote with them, but they want to be able to control what they're voting on to benefit corporations. And I think we're starting to see that reset occur.
That's exactly what's happening. It's the same reset that's happening with our favorite gal pals, the AOC and the squad, right? I mean, they're supporting Global South imperialism. They're supporting all types of terrible ideas because they've been reset. They've been told how to get in line, and they can take stances on some minor things, but that's basically getting corralled back in.
So the third example is the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, announcing in sort of a surprise way, if you are vaccinated, you no longer need to wear a mask. The premise of this new policy rollout appears to incentivize people that are not vaccinated to get vaccinated so they don't have to wear a mask. But what if instead of doing that, I just didn't wear a mask anyway if I was unvaccinated? Isn't that going to be the more likely outcome?
How do you enforce it? There's no federal law against it. Florida says they're going to make it illegal for you to require a vaccine passport. So if you're a local business, you can't ask somebody to see their card. So you can't enforce a mask mandate in Florida if you're a private business, even though it's private enterprise, because Florida says you can't.
So what a vaccine passport is, in my mind, is you show somebody that you have a vaccine card, and then you can do something. And if you don't have the vaccine card, you can't do something. So Florida is saying that you can't have a check that allows somebody that is vaccinated to do something that somebody that is unvaccinated can't do.
The order bans any government entity from issuing vaccine passports and prevents businesses from requiring any such documentation of consumers. So you can't even enforce the CDC's mandate that if you had a vaccination, you don't have to wear a mask, because there's no way to check. Because you can't ask a consumer if they've been vaccinated or not. Show me.
And this stems from the fact that being vaccinated is not a protected class, and Florida's attempting to more directly enforce that by saying that under no circumstances can you gate some action based on your vaccination status.
I really don't even understand this, why the CDC would do this. So right when we get back to maybe normal, which is you can stop wearing masks with your family but still wear masks out in public, they go ahead and make another venue or avenue for mutations, which to me makes no sense for medical reasons, but for capital, it makes all types of sense. Because for capital, wearing a mask says this thing is inconvenient. Wearing a mask inside of a sporting arena is inconvenient, right? Having 6 feet signs everywhere is inconvenient. Meaning to give out hand sanitizers and masks at the front of the store is inconvenient. Making security guards stand there and make sure that no one's coming without a mask on is inconvenient. Blah, 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 blah. It's all wasted money and profits. Having a day porter walk around and clean all the surfaces every 20 minutes because of high touch points. Putting up plexiglass everywhere. All those things are inconvenient to capital. Capital's resetting. It's back to normal and we get to deal with it again.
So at a very basic game theory perspective, the CDC, by withdrawing this mask mandate, is creating mutation pressure for an escape variant by instilling this slightly more convenient scenario where you don't have to wear a mask. My personal perspective is that wearing a mask isn't this giant onerous obligation that people want to make it out to be. Yes, it's annoying, but so is not being able to do anything. And when you present it under this guise of, well, we're doing it so that people that are unvaccinated will have an incentive to get vaccinated, it's just a false rationalization for a really shitty premise that people that are unvaccinated right now have no incentive to get vaccinated. They can just not wear a mask. They've won. They lasted long enough. The big bad government isn't going to tell them what to do. And it doesn't benefit anybody. Like, if we were to wait like 3 weeks until there's significantly fewer cases in the U.S., perhaps a slightly higher number of people do get vaccinated, because there are objectively people out there that want to get the vaccine but just haven't yet. You creep closer to that herd asymptote that we're never actually going to reach. But every person that's vaccinated helps prevent the spread. I don't view the mask as this huge inconvenience that a lot of people view it as. And Florida's taking this really harsh stance that says, no, we're not going to tolerate any vaccine passports. But because vaccination isn't a protected class, you can have other states that impose the opposite, which is quite literally, we only will serve people that are vaccinated. That would be completely legal. We haven't seen any states do that, but Florida's taking the opposite approach, which is we want to help create as much mutation pressure as possible. Because right to persons, effectively. They're taking that conservative, acute violence mindset of, I don't want to wear a mask, and if I get COVID and die, which is effectively acute violence, that's fine, because I had that choice.
So what's happening right now is you have lots and lots of assholes, lots of bleeders, who are tired of everybody sitting at home collecting paychecks because you can't even go out to eat anymore because there's not enough servers. And there's not enough servers because it pays more to sit at home and get paid by the government than it is for you to go to work and get $2.75 an hour and then tips. So that's the whole rationale behind unemployment, is to show the world, or at least the United States, that there's so much economic pressure to force you back to work that we gotta lift the mandates in the CDC. We gotta get you back to work, because without you, how are we gonna be tourists? How am I going to go to a mom-and-pop shop or Applebee's or some store and buy new shoes or shirts or whatever it happens to be without poor, exploited workers to help me along the way?
Quiche doesn't cook itself.
How did I get bubble tea without some poor, exploited asshole there making bubble tea for me in my little seal container, right? I can't go and stuff a bear at the mall without some person there filling it with stuffing. Everything that's in the media right now is purely propaganda to convince you and the other workers that you should go back to work. And they do it in multiple ways. They do it by saying there's pressure because you're needed. Oh God, it's your opportunity to help the United States heal from a pandemic. Let's get you back to work. Or you're just a lazy fucking asshole because you're sitting at home all day. What kind of role model are you for your kids? I mean, they're going to do that. And they do it in every newscast. Oh, restaurants are complaining they don't have enough workers. How can you be there to help? There's an airline that came out and asked their employees to come in and volunteer to go to the Sky Lounge and help clean up tables and stuff up to 2 times a month. Literal volunteerism for their job, right? Because they can't get enough workers who are willing to get paid no money to go to work. If Bernie Sanders did anything right, it was convincing Congress to give out more money, because it sure did hurt capital, and it was a wonderful thing. And as we think about capital, and as we think about every aspect of it, we know from theory that imperialism is a final form of capitalism before something happens. And the only way for them to maintain the imperialism and capital together is to heal it, is to fix it. And that means banging the drum of war. And you're seeing this in normalizing the tensions within Israel and Palestine, right? And you're seeing this as in, we're going to give you these small bits of resources to again save capital. And it's important that we communicate it that way together, so that at the end of the day, we are not taken by surprise when Biden pulls a rug on us and goes flack into full-blown capitalist again.
For future episodes and to learn more about the worker movement, join us at workermovement.com.